coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the 10th Sunday after Pentecost. And they are Genesis 9 verses 8 to 17, Psalm 136 verses 1 to 9, Ephesians 3 verses 14 to 21, and the Gospel according to Mark chapter 6 verses 45 to 56. Leading today's session is David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Ethan Stoppenhagen.
All right, Ethan, here's what you have to do of try to connect two parts of the gospel lesson. The first part that got my attention was Jesus commanded the disciples to take heart, which is a way of, saying have courage. And then near the end of the reading, Mark explains that the disciples did not understand what Jesus was telling them because their hearts were hardened. And so I think the text, obviously, the way that Mark sets this up, what takes place in the heart is we have to understand that what takes place on the outside is affecting what's taking place in the heart, and that in the things that are going on in the heart, and whatever that means, it's a metaphor for the inner life or the soul or whatever, that has priority over the things that are going on outside. So the material events, the outside events, are Jesus calming the storm, and then Mark refers back to the feeding of the 5,000 with the fish and the loaves. Those are the external events, but it's what's happening in the heart that we're supposed to see, both valuing the material thing, but also the spiritual. And what's happening in the heart seems to be that nothing is happening, right? Jesus tells the disciples to take heart, to have courage. And of course, Mark will record on the rest of his gospel all the times that the disciples failed to take courage. And obviously that reached its low point on Good Friday when everyone scattered, right? So Jesus is commanding to take heart never actually took root in the heart. So, and then it's odd that Mark says at the end that the disciples were astonished, and that wasn't a compliment, right? They were somehow, they didn't quite trust what Jesus was doing because they didn't understand the meaning of the miracle of feeding of the 5,000. So I have three things to say addressing our heart failures, we could call it that.
Are the heart failures basically unbelief then?
Not trusting. Yeah, I'm
not trusting. Lack
unbelief
of faith.
Is okay. Not a word that has a lot of currency for me. It's used too often.
Sure.
But the reason why I use trust is because it depends upon a prior truth, right? Everyone's
gotcha.
Afraid of the word truth, but if you do not have truth, you can't have trust. And so mm-hmm. I'm going to go more with trust on this, but thanks for pointing that out.
Yep.
All right, so the first material circumstance was fearful. And what we find is that not only were the disciples scared because of nature became unhinged, excessive winds, excessive water, being alone on the boat. So that was fearful enough. But the odd thing is, Mark records, Jesus intensified the disciples' fear of dying by appearing to be the angel of death. Now, in that particular culture, if you see the angel of death, it means he's coming to get your souls, right? He's claiming ownership of you. So why would Jesus intensify the disciples' fearfulness before he relieves it? I mean, it's too easy to say, but the fact is, if we're going to trust that Jesus has a real deliverance, the only way we'll ever learn to trust that is if we are confronted with real evil, that not only confronted by, but that we are overwhelmed by real evil. And I think the reason why Mark and all the gospel writers say it, that it is a record of their failures to trust Jesus. Yes, it's a record of Jesus' teaching, but the disciples never look very good. They always fail to grasp what Jesus is saying. And I think that the point is that not only does Jesus demonstrate his trustworthiness in us facing real evil, but he reveals that he can be trusted in when we fail, and that he comes with forgiveness. So this confrontation is not only in the confrontation with evil; it happens afterwards when we fail, and Christ comes back with his presence, not with condemnation, but with this forgiveness. That and that's why he raised their fears to fever pitch in appearing to be what the Greek says, a phantom. And so that's the first thing, that when Christ says fear not, he is not promising to insulate us from fearful circumstances. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The way that he dealt with the disciples, is, I presume, this way he will deal with us, is that he will lead us into fearful circumstances. As you mentioned last week with Psalm 23, that he will bring us into the presence of the enemies and then say, calm down, here's dinner, right? Relax. Well, that is, just because someone says relax doesn't mean that we will relax. So secondly, I think Jesus presumes his followers will repeatedly fail to take heart. The command doesn't create immediate, you know, obedience or success. The command is doing something else. And I think it's going to be in the failure of the command and in the forgiveness that follows that failure. Now, having said that, I have grown up in a culture in which forgiveness was an excuse for lassitude and not trying, and it was lifeless. Forgiveness wasn't an energy to try again. Forgiveness was an excuse to say trying is useless and futile, and so why put the effort in? So you can tell that I think forgiveness is a word that continually needs to be defined by the way it is used in Scripture, and not by some external doctrine that forgiveness, no matter what you do, you're forgiven, and therefore what you do is unimportant. Never in the Bible does it say that what we do is unimportant, even if what we do is forgiven. All right, so that's a long screed about what I'm kind of my inner conflict. So Christ is trying to show his disciples that his presence is the decisive difference, and if it's decisive, then his forgiveness will not lead to timidity or lethargy. It will lead to ever increasing confidence that we can enter into the fearful circumstances, trusting that where we fail, we will be forgiven. So I think that this, the way that trust and forgiveness is being used here, is best expressed in a colic that comes from King's College, right down the street from Jamie. It's a little known institution called King's College, and they have a Christmas Eve service called the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols. And in the 1941 edition, there was a colic that was written called The Call of Abraham. 1941, England is being decimated by the German Blitz. Fear is at its height. People were despairing. And here's the colic. I think, Ethan, you have read this before. Oh, God, you have called your servants to ventures which we cannot see the ending, by paths yet untrodden, through perils unknown. Give us faith to go out with courage. That's the energy that this forgiveness and faith gives. That's the energy I think this passage is showing the disciples putting them in those circumstances. And it goes on, not knowing where we go, but only that your hand is leading us and that your love supporting us. All right, so Jesus is saying, my presence is decisive. It's decisive not because it will insulate you from fearful circumstances, but rather it will lead you into these fearful circumstances, into the eye of the storm, or into the utter hunger, and you will find that it will that presence will be decisive. Now, how we'll discover that? It's not clear. So the third thing that comes from this is that what looks like a nonsensical observation, a non sequitur, Mark records in a series of loosely connected events that Jesus got into the boat, the wind ceased, the disciples were utterly astounded, and then he gives an editorial comment because they did not understand about the loaves. And their hearts were hardened. So they had this experience. They were gratified to be saved, but they didn't get the point. The failure to see that the command to take heart somehow did not hit home. So the first two remarks make sense. Jesus calmed the winds. They could appreciate that his presence. No one ever said, like they did in other instances, "Lord, don't you care?" No one ever said, "Lord, why did you scare us even further?" Right? All they did is they were just happy that Christ was there and the storm had passed. But that wasn't the main point. They had missed the main point. They had missed it because Mark said they were astonished at this rather than what would be the alternative. That rather than that, they came to understand that Jesus' presence really is decisive. And why should they have gotten that? Because they had just experienced Jesus taking a few fish and loaves and turning it into the thing that sustained the people. The point was, had they gotten the point from the fish and loaves, they would have navigated that fearful circumstance in the boat much differently, but they didn't. They were happy to be fed, and then they forgot the lesson. They were happy to be saved, and then they forgot the lesson. They didn't realize that all of this is an ongoing narrative in which Christ is getting across to them in a world that's scary and filled with scarcity. That's the two things that are going on, scariness and scarcity, that Christ's presence is, as Paul says, sufficient. Now, I like the way that Mark's realism. That's a hard lesson to learn. Maybe we don't actually ever learn that lesson, right? You almost get the idea that Mark is saying that, okay, in this life we fear and we fear and we fear and we fear, and then suddenly the fear is gone. And then we realize all along we didn't need to fear this very fearful world. But that's a revelation which is a gift. And so I think sometimes it happens within life, but certainly it happens at the end of life. And so I'm going to conclude with this kind of, I think one of the most interesting points in the liturgy is when we say to the people, "Lift up your hearts." And they respond, "We lift them up to the Lord." And it's too bad that we don't understand the genealogy of that phrase. This is, the lifting of the heart is a huge freedom that God has given us. A heart that are heavy with grief or hearts that are scared with fear. That when we get into the presence of God in the Eucharist, there it is possible for us to be bid that I can actually say, "Lift up your hearts," and that is a possibility. And people freely say, "We lift them to the Lord." That here is a declaration. We do not want to be governed by fear. We want to take heart and have and that taking heart depends on Christ being really present.
Every point that you made, you know, it just sort of hit home for me how much we sort of gloss over this text and make very little of it. And Jesus just becomes, you know, just the impressive guy on the water, and the disciples are scared and they don't get it. And that's the end of the story. But to see how, you know, how this connects with everything that Jesus is trying to teach about his presence being as you say, decisive, right? That it's making a difference in the lives of his people continually. That is just so impactful for me. But then with that also the forgetfulness of the disciples and how much we are like the disciples and how, you know, Christ appears in our presence week in and week out. And we treat it as if, you know, as if nothing has happened, right? That we haven't just experienced a miracle. Yeah, there's just so many threads to pick up on here. I think maybe the biggest thing for me is the forgiveness, because that's not one that's explicit here in the text, is how,
right,
how forgiveness, becomes for the disciples the opportunity, the drive to try again, to continue to do better.
I think that's exactly what preaching is.
Yeah.
Right? It is 52 weeks of failure, but the thing is, the failure doesn't lead to quitting. It leads to, I know I can do this better.
Right. 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 Well, and you're, as you do that, you're doing the same thing for the people. That's I think in some ways your message to them is that, you know, we're trying week in and week out and we fail, and yet we have this gift of forgiveness that we receive daily, and that drives us forward to
okay
to
I want to just say
to
something
courage.
About you say it's implied. I think it's more than implied, because the forgiveness, it's not explicit, but this is an incident in the whole gospel, and the whole gospel, all of the gospels, as I said, are records of the disciples' failure and mm-hmm. Jesus's patience in bringing them back and back and back. And then the cumulative effect is that after the resurrection, they actually go out into the world. They're still fearful. They're still sinful. But something had taken root and taken hold. And I wish that I had recognized this earlier. But just a huge amount of that Christ's love is expressed in a patience in which he's willing to keep coming back and teaching the disciples over and over again, right? And very rarely becoming frustrated with their unbelief, but rather, and then you see why Paul said the first corollary of God's love is patience. That's the gospels are records of that, of, as I said, we fail and we fail and we fail, and then suddenly the failure stops. And it might be death, but it also might be, that we have learned something. So, and what is it that we have learned? The psalm makes it clear by the repetition that God's steadfast love endures forever. This is why I think Mark is focusing on the heart, because that's where love does its work. I don't like using the word love because it's a worn out term. It's been used in so many disastrously terrible ways, right? But the fact is that the one thing that God intends to repeat that we will never get is that his steadfast love endures forever. And if we are loved with a steadfast love, our lives are different. We don't know how they're different. Doesn't mean that we are suddenly great people, or that we dance over fearful circumstances, or that we're generous to a fault. It just means that whatever else we can say, we are beloved. And I think the Gospels say we experience that belovedness when Christ comes back to us after we have failed, and he comes back with forgiveness and reconciliation over and over and over again, because you cannot get too much love in your life. There cannot be too much forgiveness. 7 times 70, Jesus says. And even that will be insufficient. So the psalm may seem repetitious because of the, you know, the response that his steadfast love endures forever. But I like the way the repetition says, you're not going to get this lesson. I'm going to say it. You're going to hear the words. You're going to be able to repeat it, but you're not going to be able to learn it. You'll be astonished by it, but you will be still, you'll have a hardened heart that needs that to be repeatedly won over to God's steadfast love.
We need that mantra, right? And then I think there you see in this psalm especially, you see how you see the liturgy, right? The call and the response. So a word is spoken and the people respond, for his steadfast love endures forever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, great to do this psalm in, you know, responsively in that way. As, you know, as the people continually say, his steadfast love endures forever, no matter, you know, no matter what we have, no matter how we have misstepped and sinned against him.
Yeah. I can remember as a little child just being so irritated by psalms like this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you what endures forever. This psalm. Get over. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So now we get to a completely different approach to God's love in Noah. And the, what makes it completely different is the fact that God repeats in these, that God said, the passage repeats, God said, and Robert Alter, the Jewish scholar, says, this is a phrase that's an idiom. When it's repeated like this, it means Noah needs to be reassured that the covenant that God is making can be trusted. So Noah trusted God and built an ark, right? Noah trusted God and endured the ark. But when Noah also endured the utter decimation of creation and creatures, and the text seems to be saying that Noah was not overwhelmed by God's love, but by God's destructiveness. That you have kind of the survivor syndrome going, with all of this death around me, why did we survive? Is it something inside of me? Is it something, is it just dumb luck? Or is it something in God? Because if it's in God, I have just seen God being utterly destructive. And what, how do I know that somehow I can be the object of God's love? What is it? And so Noah needs reassurance. And so God says over and over again that the reason why Noah survived is because God intends on dealing with us by giving us gifts. That his survival is an utter and unmerited gift. And that's how God intends to deal with all humanity. And even the flood, in a way, was God's intention to not destroy the whole world, but to have the world again live in a relationship with him that is based upon his gifts. So Noah's trust in God was battered, and so the rainbow is given as a token of this comfort. And so that physical sign, that the sign of color and of beauty and of calm, is physically there, that the covenant that God speaks is what endures forever, and the destructive judgment is only there to serve that love. And I like that God has to repeat it three times, because that is the message we will never learn. The destruction seems to be what's real, and the love seems to be tacked on as kind of a soporific or kind of a cheap consolation. And God is saying, no, the judgment is passing. It's the love that endures forever. And that the big lesson in life for all of us, but especially for Noah, was that this is a promise that can be trusted. It won't be easy, but it can be trusted. And life becomes an ongoing revelation of why God's trustworthiness, when we discover it to be actually everything that God has said it was. So Ephesians, it takes us again, the text work beautifully. Paul says, as we said earlier, Mark is interested in the heart, right? The heart is where we take heart, where we lift up our hearts, where we harden heart. Paul calls this the inner man, right? That the real story of life is not what's happening in the material world. The material will serve this, but the real story of life is what's happening in the esoanthropon, the heart. And Paul then says, if that's the real story going on, if that's a story that endures forever, then tribulation and material hardship are not what we think they are. They are not the things that we should fear at all costs. The things materially that scare us because of the scarcity. What they say to us, in one sense, our lives are a long defeat, what Tolkien called the long defeat, in which he imaged in The Lord of the Rings, where even after all of the great successes, the world's finally come to an end. Right? That finally, as Paul says, that the outer self wastes away, and only after that has done, that the death has exercised its victory over the outer self, only then do we see that the real story has been all along going on inwardly in the heart, which is more real because it's more lasting, and it's a story that is ruled not by judgment but by love. And Paul says, here's how it works. It takes root. And so he uses a really, really cool word there, that when the way that God's love works, it's just this tiny little thing, but it takes root and it gains momentum. It's a momentum of growth, and you can only see it by faith and not by sight. And so we say, what's going on in the heart? And Paul uses the word rizao, which is the word taking root. Radix is the word for root, and that spawned a philosophical term called rhizomatic, which means that life goes out not as a monolithic, mechanical, straightforward, predictable way. That in the world of science, it's that you follow a straight and narrow path to the predicted point, and that's what true knowledge is. That's not what Paul says God's knowing God is. It is rhizomatic. It is sending out roots in all sorts of unpredictable ways and going into all sorts of different parts of life. And the thing about root growth is when you stress a root, it plows through and it takes different directions. When you see a little tiny root coming up through the concrete, that is rhizomatic, the rhizomatic in spades. It keeps at it. And if it doesn't break through, it goes around. But life will not be stopped is Paul's point. It looks like life is being stopped if you just look at the physical. But what's really going on, this is a story of God's love. And that story, when it takes root, it goes into the breadth and height and length and depth of all reality, turning a dying world into the life of God's love, which is life forever.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.